Welcome to another edition of Eye on the Peninsula, this Tuesday, the 19th of April. Good afternoon, I'm Piers Cunningham. Thanks for joining us. Today we take a look back to the unveiling of the Frankston War Memorial in the lead up to the Anzac Day, where we hear from various dignitaries and an ex-serviceman. We talk to Councillor Antonella Celli from Sea Winds Ward about the name change from Rosebud West to Capel Sound. And we hear why ratepayers have to foot the bill for footpaths in Somers and Frankston. But first, over the past 10 years, there's been an alarming growth in the use of crystal methamphetamines, commonly known as ice. Governments have been working hard to stem the increase, and media information has been plentiful, if not possibly exaggerated at times. Local Peninsula group Peninsula Voice are holding a forum on Wednesday, the 27th of April 2016, to better inform residents of the true nature of the future plans to attack this tragic drug. In this article, Ray Reid discusses what ice is and provides further information on the forum.
Ice, what is it? It's also known as crystal meth, shabu, crystal, glass and shard, is a stimulant drug, which means it speeds up the messages travelling between the brain and the body. It is a type of methamphetamine, which is generally stronger and more addictive and has more harmful side effects than the powder form known as speed. Ice usually comes as small, chunky, clear crystals that look like ice. It can also come as white and brownish crystal-like powder with a strong smell and bitter taste. Ice is generally smoked or injected, and the effects can be felt in 3 to 7 seconds. It is sometimes swallowed, 15 to 30 minutes to feel the effects, or snorted, 3 to 5 minutes to feel the effects. The effects of ice can last for around 6 hours, but it might be hard to sleep for a few days after using the drug. Its effects may include feelings of pleasure and confidence, increased alertness and energy, repeating simple things like itching and scratching, enlarging pupils and dry mouth, teeth grinding and excessive sweating, fast heart rate and breathing, reduced appetite and increased sex drive. But it also increases the risk of hepatitis B and C, HIV and AIDS. An overdose may cause racing heartbeat and chest pain, breathing problems, fits or uncontrolled jerking, extreme agitation, confusion and clumsiness, sudden severe headache, unconsciousness, stroke, heart attack, or even death. It can take several days to come down from using ice. The following effects may be experienced during this time: difficulty sleeping and exhaustion, headaches, dizziness and blurred vision, paranoia, hallucinations and confusion, irritability and feeling down, and long-term effects can be devastating. It is a drug that is growing in popularity every single day. 7% of Australians aged 14 and over have used methamphetamines one or more times in their lives. 2.1% of Australians aged 14 years and over have used methamphetamines in the previous 12 months. Of these people, 50.4% report crystal or ice as main form of the drug they used. Young Australians aged 14 to 24 first try methamphetamines at 18.6 years of age, and 2.9% of 12 to 17-year-olds have tried amphetamines. In Victoria, the daily number of all amphetamine-related ambulance attendances in 2012 and 13 increased significantly compared with the previous year. 88% increase in metropolitan Melbourne and a 198% in regional Victoria. This is attributed to an increase in the number of attendances relating to crystal methamphetamine or ice. In metropolitan Melbourne, there was an 88% increase in the number of attendances for ice between 2011 and 2012 and 2012 and 2013, up to an average of 3 per day. In regional Victoria, the increase was 198%, up to 0.63 times per day. Young people have the impression that this is a magic drug that brings them the biggest high, but few seem to realise that just one fix on ice could lead to this.
As a doctor treating more and more people who use the drug ice, I see some terrible things. Users who can't sleep for days at a time. Some smoke it, not realising that's just as addictive.
No, I'm going out, all right?
Ice destroys lives. It tears families apart. Some ice users dig at their arms, feeling like bugs are crawling under the skin. And then there's the psychotic episodes. It's frightening that addiction can happen in such a short time. Don't let ice destroy you.
Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
The impact on family is intense and may be long-term. On the 27th of April 2016, a public forum is to be held that will dispel some of the common myths and will counter the hysteria that has emerged in the media. The forum will provide empirical evidence regarding the drug and provide individuals and the community with tangible steps we can each take to move the incidence of addiction in a different direction. The forum is to be held on Wednesday, the 27th of April 2016, between 6:30 and 9 p.m. It'll be held at the Peninsula City Church, 252 Frankston Flinders Road in Frankston. I hope to see you there. I'm Ray Reid for the Eye of the Peninsula.
What a great insight into the effects of ice. And if you want to know more about the ICE forum Peninsula Voice is holding, visit peninsulavoice.org. Last week, Eye on the Peninsula brought you a report on the unveiling of the new location of the Frankston War Memorial. Today, we continue our report from the service at the memorial with a focus on the Anzac spirit. Deborah Maher gathered interviews from a number of dignitaries, starting with the president of the Frankston RSL, Mr. Kevin Hillier, who addressed the people at the service.
Today, we honour those who have served and suffered the supreme sacrifice. They shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.
We'll remember them.
It is indeed a great honour for me today to represent all serving and ex-servicemen and women who have called Frankston their home at the opening of this memorial. It's been a long, drawn-out process for at least 10 years, and I thank the committee members from the RSL for their diligence and commitment to attaining this memorial in these surroundings.
Now, it's a very emotional and proud day for you today. A lot of people have turned up at the Frankston War Memorial to commemorate our fallen. How was it for you today?
It's very touching and, as you say, very emotional. It's been a very long journey to get this in the park for something that's really relevant to the service that the men and women of Frankston have given. And it's been a great turn-up today, so I'm really proud that many members of the public have come as well.
And where did you serve, Kevin?
I was in Vietnam, I was in the Navy, and travelled backwards and forwards on the Bung Tau Ferry. So I did 7 trips to Vietnam on the Bung Tau Ferry, taking trips up and back.
We've got a lot of people out here who are also very proud. Yeah, so best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Frankston RSL President Mr. Kevin Hillier there. Mayor of Frankston City, Councillor James Dooley, said this.
But it is upon all of us to actually reflect, but more importantly, continue to honour the Anzac tradition born on the shores of Gallipoli. So your support this morning is yet another chapter, both in the nation's rich heritage and also here in Frankston, in the Frankston municipality, of honouring those who have gone before us, those who currently serve, and hopefully into the future peace may come to our land and the lands of the world, and we may not have to see conflict. And it is also now my great pleasure to introduce our Mayor, Councillor James Dooley, to speak to you all. Ladies and gentlemen, the Mayor. This project has been the result of an amazing joint effort. Council, the Frankston RSL and community members have all contributed significant funding to get it off the ground. Community contributions have largely been driven by the Women for Frankston War Memorial, who worked tirelessly to raise funds by running a number of events and tin rattles.
There are also a number of generous donations from local businesses that enabled this project to progress to where it is now. And we're delighted to be gathered here today to officially dedicate the new Frankston War Memorial here in its new home of Beauty Park. Relocating has offered many benefits. It has allowed us to build a memorial that is fitting, honouring the huge legacy that our servicemen and women have left for our community. This picturesque location also offers more space, enabling our community members to visit and commemorate the sacrifices of the brave men and women who have served our country. And it also provides access for veterans, disabled and frail community members, enabling a more convenient marching route and car parks. As part of the ongoing project, names of the returned servicemen and women will continue to be engraved on the new memorial. This has started with the names of 228 First World War veterans. From the enormous crowds from the 2015 Anzac Day commemorations attracted, it is clear that there is a growing community interest in recognising and celebrating our veterans. And 2016 should be no different, with significant anniversaries from World War I, World War II and the Vietnam War to commemorate. This year, Anzac Day centenary commemorations are still underway. It is also the 75th anniversary of the capture of Tobruk and the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Long Tan. The open space around Beauty Park Memorial will cater for the large crowds also who commemorate these significant events, and we expect that will be attracted to the Anzac Day 2016 services.
And that was Frankston City Mayor, Councillor James Dooley. Lastly, we'll hear from Federal Member for Dunkley, Mr. Bruce Bilson, who spoke about the lucky country we live in.
Thank you to all of you for being here today. This is a really special occasion for our community. And as has been outlined by Councillor Dooley, one that wouldn't have been achieved if it was not for the collaboration and the contribution of many. This is a significant day because this is a sacred place. We know during World War I, 40% of all young men aged between 18 and 44 went off to serve our country. They left our peace and our prosperity to go to places we like not to think about. I know through my time as the Minister for Veterans Affairs, some of the vivid recollections of those who've served are quite extraordinary, having to see things and do things we hope never come our way in the course of our life. And we as a community made our contribution, a substantial contribution. So many of our young men went off to fight and so many gave so much, and they are the first that are recognised behind us. And that's something we need to pause and reflect on, and that's why commemorative occasions are important in our community and why I'm as encouraged as many about the number of people, particularly young people, that come along. When you stop and think about Grand Final Day at the MCG, that sea of faces, 100,000 citizens thinking about what the game might mean for them on that day, replace those fans with the fallen. 102,000 of our greatest citizens have given their lives for our country to be as free and as full of optimism and positivity. I think we should all show our respect for those that have served that are amongst us today, those veterans that have come back to make a further contribution to their nation beyond their service, and their families that have supported them through what can be a difficult journey. Thank you on behalf of a grateful nation. And it's from that foundation we're here today. We think about the future of our country and how some wonder whether democracy is the greatest way to organise government. Tell you what, it beats the hell out of anything else, doesn't it? But that's a privilege and a good fortune, a blessing that we enjoy as Australians that hasn't come easy. And when our serving men and women travel around the world, we're not looking to conquer other countries. We don't even ask for enough land to bury our dead these days. We just want those other peoples to share what we love and enjoy. Chance to be our best selves, to map our own course. Where we decide the direction of our country by the calibre of our leaders, not the calibre of a firearm. Where the weight of argument and ideas shapes our choices, not the weight of impression. And isn't that something worth celebrating every day? And here is a place where we can connect with that story and the great gift and renew our promise to those that paid so much, that we will protect what they've won for us and we will respect and support those that have done those hard yards. That's why this is a sacred place. It is a place of commemoration. It's a place of thanksgiving. We count our blessings. We won life's lottery. We are Australians. We choose our course. We have freedoms others dream of and die for. Well, we've got those things. And that's why this place has to be the beating heart of our community. Where we remind ourselves that that hasn't come easy. It's come at great costs. That's why it is an honour and a privilege to be with you today. I thank you for the courtesy of a few minutes of your time. I invite you to put this place in your heart as those it commemorates had our nation in their heart, and we are the beneficiaries of that.
That's Federal Member for Dunkley, Mr. Bruce Bilson, who I'm sure is speaking on behalf of all Australians.
98.7, 98.3, RPP, the Peninsula's biggest variety.
Continuing on the Anzac story. On August the 18th, 1966, in a rubber tree plantation near Long Tan in South Vietnam, a battle between Australian troops and the Viet Cong raged for 4 hours. In heavy monsoonal rain, the Australians fought in defensive positions and called in artillery to prevent the enemy from overwhelming them. At 7 p.m, a relief force arrived, and as evening fell, the enemy withdrew. 18 Australians were killed and 24 wounded. The Australian government and the Royal Australian Mint are releasing a series of coins to commemorate the 100 years of Anzac, including the Battle of Long Tan. Local ex-serviceman Dave Sabin fought in the Battle of Long Tan and is featured on one of the coins sitting next to a rubber tree. He attended the Frankston War Memorial unveiling last week and had this to say to Deborah Maher.
Well, I was in the first intake of National Service, and I was called up in mid-65. I went to officer training course and was posted to 6th Battalion. So I went to Vietnam between mid-66 and mid-67, and I served with 6th Battalion in their first tour, and I was a platoon commander at the Battle of Long Tan.
So what sort of memories does that bring back for you when we gather here today and remember all our fallen?
When we stand and think about the fallen, obviously I think about the ones that I knew. We had 17 in our company killed, and the immediate reaction is, you know, what those people missed out on. They died at 20, 21, and it hits very hard.
How do you deal with something like that in real life?
Oh, it's very difficult, but you do get over it. It's like being involved in a train smash or an aircraft accident. Everything around you is in vivid detail, but you're able to put it behind you and you can refer back to it, and so you move on, you get over it. But it's forever with you, always with you. Something as traumatic as that.
Ex-serviceman Dave Sabin, who fought in the Battle of Long Tan. Dave also organises Long Tan trek tours and battlefield tours to Vietnam. Visit his website, sabin.com, for more details. And remember to dig deep and buy a poppy to support returned servicemen and women and their families. And check the RPPFM website for details of Anzac Dawn services on the peninsula. We now cross to David Harrison, local journalist, commentator, and observer of current affairs and news on the Mornington Peninsula. David had this to say on the Breakfast Club program on RPPFM yesterday morning with Brendan Telfer about a number of issues on the peninsula, starting with the Rosebud West name change to Capel Sound, followed by Amy Henson, who spoke with Councillor Antonella Celli to discuss why Councillor Celli disapproves of the name change.
Capel Sound, it looks like it's through. It just needs Victorian Government approval now for the renaming of Rosebud West.
Hugh Fraser, who's very interested in history and has done a lot of work about the first Victorian settlement at Sorrento, took us back to 1854, I think it was, and said that the area was known as the parish of Capel Sound from 1858 onward and is marked on a survey map as that. And at that stage, Rosebud was then known as Wananui. Antonella Charlie described it as a foreign name, which I suppose it is. Every non-Aboriginal name is a foreign name in Australia, including Rosebud.
I'm surprised that there is opposition to the change. I mean, why would some of the councillors, I think Antonella Charlie is one, who is against the name change. I'm a little surprised. Why would that be so? What's the drama? Why is there a concern about it?
Councillor Charlie spoke quite eloquently on their behalf. Councillor Ann Shaw said that the figures that the Shire had done were a bit sus on how many people wanted the name change, and said that the figures didn't show a majority in favour of the change. But in the end, I think people are entitled to have what they want.
At last week's council meeting, Mornington Peninsula councillors had their vote on whether or not they wanted to implement the name change from Rosebud West to Capel Sound. After a survey was sent to 5,600 ratepayers, businesses and community groups of Rosebud West last November, 1,065 were in favour of the name change and 837 were against the name change. I'm speaking with Councillor Antonelli Celli on why she opposes the name change. So who started the idea of changing the township's name and why?
It was actually instigated by Mr. Terry Wright with a few residents from Rosebud West who call themselves Capel Sound 3940. They instigated the name change because they believe that Rosebud West doesn't have a proper name or identity, and that this name change will install a new sense of pride in the area.
Councillor Celli, you're against the name change. Why?
In my debate on the 11th of April, when a council decision voted for the change, I spoke against the name change. I was representing the community and the voice of the community leaders, who are the generational locals who live in the area and who did not want the name change. The community overall could see no valid reason for the name change because they identify quite well with the area and its name already. So they see the name of Rosebud West as being an intrinsic part of their identity, and they also realise the time and cost implications for businesses should a name change proceed to be approved. I've not been supportive of this since I first heard about it, and since the community reported back to me that they also didn't want it. I and many others in the community, from educators to social welfare providers, local VicPol, schools, environmental advocates, know how much the community has worked with local, state and federal government to address the complex issues in Rosebud West through substantial investment in the Community Renewal Program over the many years since 2010. The Community Renewal Program has seen vast social, environmental and economical improvements in the area and has enhanced the sense of place and identity for Rosebud West and its residents. Rosebud West has a good reputation, it has a good name, and is in good standing with local, state and federal programs and initiatives, attracting millions of dollars of investment into the township that has gone towards vocational training to address education and employment needs, infrastructure renewal like the building of the Seawinds Hub, footpaths, new toilets, business support through economic development, streetscape improvements, and also social welfare programs addressing the needs of the children, families, our young people and seniors in the area. So the name of Rosebud West has earned these community improvements and the millions of dollars of investment, not the name Capel Sound. So I have very strong view in opposing the name change from Rosebud West to Capel Sound, especially on behalf of the community and the good work that's gone into that township.
Another point that was made was that residents would have more pride in their homes and the change would increase real estate prices.
That's a very interesting point to raise, Amen. As far as I know, the residents already have a sense of pride living in Rosebud West. As for increasing real estate prices, that is such a furphy, and I have to say it's a real furphy. Capel Sound is just semantics. What does it mean to a buyer? It's not as if it's known as Toorak or a Portsea. It has no real estate reputation like Rosebud West has actually earned at the moment. I'm not sure if many people know this, but since 2010, Rosebud house prices have been going up exponentially. So no, a name change wouldn't increase the real estate prices. Rosebud West has been doing a good job for itself. It's all speculation and actually a manufactured inflation by the real estate market and those who support that notion.
So the survey indicated that more ratepayers wanted the name to change. It was, I believe, 228 votes difference between yes and no. So doesn't this actually stand as a fair representation of the people who want the name change?
It may look that way, but if you look at the survey results, Amy, at face value, the numbers look more in favour of a name change. But analysing the figures closely, as a thinking person would, will actually show, in fact, only 33% of responses were received from 5,600 surveys that went out. So a whopping 66.14% actually did not respond to that. So to me, and to many community members, that isn't reflective of a majority of the community who participated. Out of those responses of 1,065, which is only 19% of the total posted, voted yes, compared to 837, 14.84% of total posted voted no, including a petition of 356 who were against, and a majority no vote from Village Glen and the businesses in the industrial estate. So there is no clear majority for the name change whatsoever reflected in those results. The results just semantically show a larger number and percentage that is not reflected of the true sentiment of the majority of the community. Also, I'd like to mention, Amy, that the campaign run by the Capel Sound applicants and their distribution of unauthorised flyers at the same time as the council survey went out confused the community on how to vote. And many community members, either for or against, felt misled in that they did not need to return their surveys. So that kind of situation has the potential to destabilise the formal survey vote responses, as evidenced in the low number of responses received. So no, it's not a true reading of a majority whatsoever, in my view.
What will the process be now? The Office of Geographic Name is dealing with it.
A council decision of 7-4 has been made in favour of the change. So the residents of Rosebud West will receive a letter notifying them of the council decision, outlining the next steps. And there will be a period of 30 days from the date of the letter to lodge appeals against the name change to the Office of Geographic Names Register, Mr. John Tulloch, who is appointed by the Minister for Planning, the Honourable Richard Wynne. When it is approved by the Office of Geographic Names and within 30 days of the proposal's approval, the OGN will publish a notice on the proposal's website and send notifications to the naming authority, in this case the Shire, and notifications will then go out to the community.
And that was Councillor Antonella Celli with Amy strongly opposing the name change. We stay with David Harrison, who continues to talk with Brendan Telfer about the Frankston pavement debate, which raises similarities with Summers.
Couple of local issues, David. We heard in the local news today that there are a few dramas for the Frankston Council. They're going to be charging local ratepayers up to 65% for repairs for pavements. And I was thinking to myself, you might be able to comment on that, because there's been a bit of an issue over at Summers for a while about pavements and pathways, hasn't there?
Well, it's been an issue about footpaths in particular in special charge schemes, where the Shire usually charges ratepayers about 35%, around about that, of the cost of the work. It looks as though Frankston are going to use footpaths the way that we think the Shire is hoping to use footpaths, and that is as a way of raising revenue outside of the rates cap.
A letter apparently did go out to ratepayers suggesting that it was the rates cap that's really hurting them, that as a consequence they're going to just have to get stuck into people.
This is yet to get the okay from the Essential Services Commission, which is setting up the rate cap scheme, and we'll be monitoring councils to make sure that they're standing by it. They may not allow councils to use special charge schemes in this way, especially with the legal advice as it stands that, you know, you can call anything a special charge scheme, which would quite clearly be in contrast to what the government wants to do, and that is to stop councils spending as much money as they like. The rates on the Mornington Peninsula, for example, have gone up well over 100% in the last 10 or 12 years. It'll eventually hunt people off the peninsula who can't afford to pay that sort of escalating rate. Footpath to your house, you're regarded as getting a direct benefit from it, a direct advantage. For example, if a footpath goes up one side of a road, people on both sides of the road are in fact required to pay for it. But in Summers, where there's a bit of a row, the council is proposing to collect contributions for a footpath which is 2 kilometres away from their place.
And that's right, and there's the rub, of course, and everybody a little bit upset over there. In fact, they've really organised themselves quite well, haven't they? And it also, it's interesting to see that the reaction we're getting, at least some reports out of Frankston, is that people are just going to refuse to pay this sort of money, and I just wonder where that could lead.
Well, what it leads to is the council is entitled to put a charge against your rates, which is recovered from the property when it's sold. If it goes long enough, it'll be worth more than the value of the property.
Frankston City Mayor's office was asked for comment and have yet to reply. David also commented on the Victorian Planning Minister Richard Wynne's action to take control of the $18 million Skylift project.
What's been happening up around the chairlift?
Well, we've had Richard Wynne calling the project in a most unusual way. The council was dealing with secondary consent from a VCAT decision, and it's full of things that had to be wrapped up. When the proponent assured VCAT that they would be able to evacuate the chairlift within so many minutes, the tribunal was, and I quote, comforted by that. No empirical evidence, but just an assurance from people who have got a special interest in this game. The council was left with ends to tidy up, and they were being told by council officers, no, you can't make any changes to these. Well, why give secondary consent to a council when all they're supposed to do is rubber stamp it? There were some genuine problems, and Richard Wynne has inherited the biggest one, which is the fire problem on the top of Arthur's Seat, the fact that you could get thousands of people up there and circumstances where it would be almost impossible to get everybody away from the danger area, and no sort of fire shelter at all. The Shire should be lobbying the government to put up a structure there which would hold at least 500 people, if not more. They are not protected at the moment.
Mornington Peninsula Mayor Councillor Graham Pittick said the state government taking over planning power for the Arthur Seat Skylift project was a slap in the face for local government. You'll hear more about that issue, particularly on the bushfire risk on Arthur's Seat, in later reports on Eye on the Peninsula.
98.7, 98.3, RPP. The Peninsula's biggest variety.
Coming up on Eye on the Peninsula, we take you down to the official launch of the Abacus Learning Centre in Hastings. But first, in 2014, the Napthine government was offering a 50-year development plan for the quarantine station precinct on the southern peninsula, revolving around a health and fitness centre, a spa, restaurant, hotel and conference centre, plus a coastal and climate research centre. But the Andrews government rejected the idea on the basis of the scale of the development and the lease terms. Now an alternate plan appears to be in the offing, and the Melbourne University announcement is the best indication yet that a compromise deal is not too far off. Federal Environment Minister Greg Hunt is quoted by The Age saying, "The deal provides the community with some much-needed certainty and makes good use of some of the empty buildings that have been lying dormant in the national park for years." If the deal comes off, Melbourne University will invest some $10 million in a 5-year redevelopment plan, which will form the basis of a broader development plan for the quarantine site. Deborah Maher is continuing to follow this important dispute that is already dividing people on the peninsula. The Abacus Learning Centre celebrated its official launch of their new premises within the Western Port Secondary College precinct in Hastings last week. Crowds gathered at the centre to thank those who donated funds and volunteered their time to get the centre up and running. Federal Minister for the Environment, Greg Hunt, gave a warm welcome to everyone in attendance. Deborah Maher first spoke to Executive Manager Nina Sutton in the purpose-built playground of the new Abacus Learning Centre.
The centre is a therapy centre for children with autism spectrum disorder. What we do is one-on-one therapy. It's called Applied Behaviour Analysis Therapy, better known as ABA therapy. And we work individually with children from the ages of 2 right through to 18. Being in a centre, we have the opportunity for the children to work together. So they do lots of social programs together. So lots of opportunities to practice communication skills, social skills, manage behaviours, things that might be scary for our kids on the spectrum. We can practice them in a really quiet, safe environment, make them feel comfortable and be able to do those skills out in the real world, in there.
How many children do you care for down here at the Abacus Learning Centre in Hastings?
At the moment, we've got 27 students who attend the centre, and then we have students in school programs who we write the programs for. We provide training to the aides at schools, and we case manage the program.
How do parents know that their children may need to be in the care of the Abacus Learning Centre?
The stories are very different for everybody who attends our centre. Some families may have autism in the family history, so are on the lookout for it at a very early age, or their child might not be developing in ways that are considered typical, so not reaching their milestones, and that may be picked up early.
How many staff members and volunteers do you have down here at the Abacus Learning Centre?
We have various levels, so I'm the executive manager and our executive director, Lauren Moore. Well, we have program supervisors, clinical director. Then we have case managers who work very closely with their group of students. Then we would have about 11 therapists who do the one-on-one therapy with the students.
Where does your funding come from?
So we don't get funding, unfortunately. We don't fall under a particular umbrella. So we're not a school, we're not a childcare. We are a therapy. People can use their FACSIA funding, they're helping children with autism funding. The only thing is, of course, with the rollout of the NDIS, we are currently an NDIS service provider.
How can the community help?
We have a website, we have a Facebook page. All of that's Abacus Learning Centre. They can easily find links through there. Feel free to contact us directly at Abacus Learning Centre.
Who would you like to thank?
So today is all about thanking all those supporters we've had. We've had project managers donated their time to use their contacts. There have been local businesses that have helped us hugely. Of course, Greg Hunt fundraising for us has always been amazing. Western Port Secondary, as you say, allow us to use these facilities in the first place. We have an amazing board of directors who work tirelessly. The list goes on and on. We can't do it without the community support. So today is about celebrating with everybody and saying a big thank you.
Executive Manager Nina Sutton speaking. Deborah also spoke to Minister Hunt, who helped raise funds for the centre when he walked around this electorate last year.
So many other people, led by Michael and Lauren Moore, the President and Executive Director of Abacus, and just huge teams of volunteers, put in, built, constructed, sourced materials, raised funds, and I thought it would take another 6 to 8 months to do. How they've got here is literally a miracle of community endeavour, and you can hear in the background the noise, and the noise is of people who are bubbling and happy. And when I asked them during the speech if perhaps everybody could just be silent, including myself for a minute, what we could hear was children and happy children and children with voice. And Abacus is about giving those children a voice. And this is something that I think everybody on the Mornington Peninsula should be really proud of.
It is self-funded and we do rely on donations and people to offer their volunteer work. Why isn't the government helping a centre like this?
It's now funding for autism through the NDIS. So that's a huge breakthrough and that wasn't happening previously. And that came from a meeting which was held at Abacus where the then Shadow Minister, Mitch Fifield, was involved, and he came away determined to have autism as part of the NDIS. And right now, we've inherited a situation where it wasn't direct funding, but that's the next big project to work on. So getting it up and running in a new facility, which is better than the old one. I thought the old one was good, but this is much better with all the outdoor area, and now it goes on the search for deeper, stronger funding.
It supports a lot of children who have autism around the Mornington Peninsula, so it's a very special place, isn't it, because it also helps children outside our area.
Well, autism is one of these conditions which, if it's treated early, can be dealt with in such a way so as to make a profound difference. And you see transformations in beautiful kids like Luke and Laurie and Kobe, who are all here and they're all on the journey. And some of the stories that the parents have given, not just from the peninsula but elsewhere, it's absolutely a sense of sadness and then relief that they had thought they were in a dark place and there was no way out of it. And Abacus has given them a sense of light and of hope that their children will have rich, meaningful lives.
Cerberus Ward Councillor David Garnock was delighted with the achievements of his community, adding,
"My role has been as a local councillor to help Abacus to identify a new location. I knew that this facility here up near the high school was vacant and not being used. And I asked the principal, Michael Devine, whether there was any chance at all that Abacus might be able to move in. He said, well, it would need a lot of work, but let's give it a go. Let's see whether they're interested. So I basically put Abacus in touch with the high school here, and it just moved on from there.
Why is it so important to the ward here and Mornington Peninsula to have such a learning centre?
We have a large number of children who have learning difficulties, particularly autism, and I know that this centre doesn't just look after kids from the Mornington Peninsula Shire, it looks after kids from a broader catchment area. We realise there's a need and happy to help in whatever way we can to look after that need.
Now, it's self-funded. Does the Shire help in any way?
When we first heard that Abacus needed to find a new location, I know the Shire's officers did work with Abacus to see if there was a site available anywhere else in another Shire facility or even land that they might be able to build on. And there was nothing really suitable, and that's why we then had to start thinking of other opportunities like this one.
Now, you're talking about people travel far and wide. This is quite a unique learning centre.
It is. I think it's the only one within Kooee of the peninsula. So I think we're very lucky to have it here, particularly in Hastings. My ward, I'm really thrilled about that.
So great work by all communities involved in setting up the Abacus Learning Centre, where children living with autism have a place to explore and learn. Well, that's it for another important week on Eye on the Peninsula. If you have any news on the street, please contact the IPPFM station on 5975 1234. Next week, Eye on the Peninsula will once again bring you up to date with issues that matter to you. We hope you can tune in next Tuesday at noon on 98.7 FM or 98.3 in Frankston. You can stream live from our website, rpfm.com.au, download the RPFM app, and visit the Eye on the Peninsula Facebook page. If you miss any Eye on the Peninsula programs, podcasts are available on our website. I'm Piers Cunningham, broadcasting at the RPFM station in Mornington. Thank you for listening.